Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your genial host, Alex Linder, for this session of the Learning College. We're going to put important information in the protocols of Zion in context. It's a hot day in the Nemo, very hot. I've actually got the AC running. I hope that doesn't make any noise. I don't think it will. I'm always hesitant to try things taping for the first time, but I don't think it will make any difference. Anyway, today you're joining me for the last segment of the red-orange bordered and backed The Protocols of Zion with preface and explanatory notes in about 10, maybe 9, maybe 11 sessions. We've covered this 300-page book. We're now in the last section, 264 through 299, to close it out. We've gone through the 24 protocols themselves, and this is more supplemental material toward the back, various bits, speeches, etc. So let's dig into it. And you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Excerpts from Congressman Lewis T. McFadden's radio address. He was an anti-communist congressman back in the 30s. Of Wednesday evening, May 2nd, 1934, as such appear in the Congressional Record of May the 3rd, 1934, dealing with a PEP plan analyzed in the Organization of British Slavery or Jew-Fabian Bolshevism. We heard about Fabianism last session, second to last. Quote, "The country has recently been treated to the spectacle of the present administration's attempt to ridicule the idea that there is a definite new plan of government in process. Without attempting to comment in any manner whatever on the attempt to disarm the public, I desire now to refer briefly to a plan that was advocated as far back as 1918, when A.A. Burrell had some very definite ideas regarding the establishment of a new state. Indeed, he wrote a little book on the significance of a Jewish state dedicated to his friend Louis D. Brandeis. In it, he regarded the Jew as, quote, the barometer of civilization at all times, unquote. He recognized the inability of Christianity to avert war or, quote, to do a single thing towards mitigating its worst effects, and he seemed to think the Jews were the only power that could do anything about it. Quote, an attempt to establish a political economic plan is now in operation under the leadership of a group formerly connected with the Fabian Society in England. This, until the present, secret political economic plan was drawn up by Israel Moses Seif, an Israelite, the director of a chain store enterprise in England called Marks & Spencer, which house handles almost exclusively imports from Soviet Russia, which enables them to undersell its competitors. I now recognize we covered this last issue, but I'll continue. There's just another couple paragraphs to go, so we're repeating two pages here. This political economic plan organization, now secretly operating in England, is designated Freedom and Planning, and it is divided into many well-organized and well-financed departments, such as Town and Country Planning, Industry, International Relations, Transportation, Banking, Social Service, Civil Division. It is already in operation in the British government by means of the Tariff Advisory Board. It has gathered all data statistics obtainable by government and private organizations in administrative, industrial, trade, social, educational, agricultural, and other circles. Iron and steel and cotton industrials have been ordered by the Tariff Advisory Board to prepare and submit plans for the reorganization of their industries, and have been warned that they should they fail to do so, a plan for a complete reconstruction will be imposed upon them. This board has been granted default powers and can, therefore, enforce its plan. That this political economic group practically control the British government is indicated by the fact that Prime Minister Macdonald and his son and J.H. Thomas and other influential Britishers are officers of the group. Quote, an interesting sidelight is that some 6 months ago, when the father of this plan, Israel Moses Seif, S-E-I-F-F, was urged to show more activity by the members of this committee, his answer was, let us go slowly for a while and wait until we see how our plan carries out in America. That statement indicates that a plan similar to theirs is being tried in America. Again, read into the congressional record from Congressman Louis T. McFadden, or Louis T. McFadden, in 1934, from his radio address, May 2, 1934. And so, next up is the Organization of British Slavery, or Jew-Fabian Socialism. On March 29, 1933, at a dinner given to the members of the PEP, Political Economic Plan, the chairman of this group, the Jew Israel Moses Seif, made a speech on, quote, planning, unquote, March 29, 1933. The speech in itself already contained some leading lines as to the aims of the PEP that can be summed up as the planned destruction of the existing order of our social, political, and economic life, and the erection of a structure based on centralization, standardization, expropriation, and compulsion, leading to inevitable enslavement. But in spite of having been somewhat rashly outspoken in his speech, Mr. Seif did in reality show a certain amount of caution, for his verbal utterances were very mild compared to his written expose on the same subject. Entitled Freedom and Planning, it was privately circulated some months ago. The perusal of this document leaves the reader no doubt for doubting the sinister outcome of the present world economic and financial crisis as viewed by United Jews and Fabians. The Jewish plans for the attainment of world domination have been clearly stated in the documents known as the Protocols of the Wise Men, or Elders of Zion, published in 1905 and subsequently in 1920. As to the Fabian, that's the gradual, nonviolent subversion, that's supposedly the opposite of the Marxist in implementation. The Marx would be a bloody, violent revolution. As to the Fabian subversive ideas, they have been and still are being expressed in Fabian Society's periodicals, pamphlets, and meetings. The PEP seems to be the central office wherein the propaganda for the schemes of the advancement of the Jewish power is being prepared and sent forth by a group of Fabians headed by the Jew chairman Israel Moses Seif, director of the chain stores of Marks and Spencer. It is no wonder that as Fabianism is the power ruling England today, the members of the PEP should be in close contact and constant contact with Mr. Ramsay MacDonald and his son. As Fabianism is the power ruling England today. In fact, it is rumored that the whole of the actual British government plans in the realm of economics issues from the offices of the PEP. The document above referred to, Freedom and Planning, quote-unquote, starts by giving a dark picture of, quote, collapsing civilization, unquote. It fails, however, to point out that this fearful description is about the most sweeping indictment of what has been the Jewish capitalistic and democratic experiment of world government. For it would be a monstrous mistake for any intelligent citizen of whatever nation to close his or her eyes to the evident fact that for nigh 60 years, again, 60 years before 1930s, 1870s, that for nigh 60 years the Jews have surely and rapidly, though almost invisibly, climbed to the heights of government wherefrom the masses are ruled. Politically, financially, and economically, they have seized the reins of the governments of all nations, and their invasion in the realms of social, educational, and religious fields is not less important. We are able to realize into what unfathomable abyss all organizations of our Christian civilization have been hurled, to the great prejudice of all the populations of this earth, and that is why the picture painted by the chairman of the PEP is in itself the condemnation of the Jewish method of government. It is, of course, necessary for the reader to bear in mind the fact that in describing the woeful state of the world, the Jew spokesman fails to ascribe it to the rule of the invisible Jewish government, which has Disraeli, a highly talkative if intelligent Jew, had so clearly shown, had already, in his time, penetrated all the courts and parliaments. Refer to Coningsby, that's Disraeli's novel, published in London in 1844. Let us now quote excerpts from, quote, Freedom and Planning, quote, Collapsing Civilization, unquote, quote, This generation is faced with the threat of a world collapse of modern civilization and the advent of a period comparable with the Dark Ages, which followed on the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD. We are apt to regard such statements as pleasantly sacrificing, or pleasantly sacrifying, pardonable exaggerations in the mouths of those who are trying to spur us to action against the very real ills of the time, but not meant quite seriously. The threat is serious. Chaos will overtake us if we cannot show intelligence enough to extricate ourselves. For more than a year now, nothing has enabled civilization to keep some sort of course and to ride out the storm, except the immense momentum of ordinary economic processes and the inertia of habit and custom. It is the resisting power of these forces, and not intelligence, which has thus far staved off the collapse. They cannot bring us back prosperity, but they may suffice to carry the world through the immediate crisis. If so, we shall be for a time able to live in our capital, the capital stored up from past generations, the intellectual and moral capital of men and women trained for civilization and citizenship. By what chance will the next generation have, if half of them find no employment for their youthful energies and all of them are living under the oppression of hopelessness and decay? What forms collapse will assume, no one can foresee. It may not come suddenly, where probably there will be a gradual decline with fleeting periods of revival. Next subtitle is Worldwide Economic Distress. Cracks are appearing everywhere. In China and in India, economic distress is both aggravated and concealed by the social and political unrest of which it is the main root. In South America, revolution has become epidemic in all but one or two countries of the most solid are financially in default. In Central and Southeastern Europe, financial default is imminent, but that by itself is of little moment in comparison with the consequent social and political upheaval which will follow. It is open to question whether the populations of Germany and Central Europe can be fed and kept alive next winter, and how long any organized government can control the situation in these countries. In the USA, loss of confidence is absolute. The strain of material suffering in a population, none too homogeneous, accustomed for generation to rapidly increasing prosperity, may lead to a breakdown of existing institutions and forms of government. The outcome is unpredictable, but the consequences throughout the globe may be catastrophic. World disorganization, famine, pestilence, and the submergence of our civilization are visible on the horizon. Britain's need of a prosperous world. Next subtitle. Britain cannot, however, prosper in a distressed world. Entirely dependent on external trade for her food and raw material, Britain cannot escape world catastrophe by isolating herself. Moreover, the worldwide loss of control of the machinery of civilization is all too visible in Britain and British institutions. If Britain is to save herself and give the world that leadership which is urgently demanded, the first need is for a complete reconstruction of our national life on lines fitted for the new needs of the 20th century. Here a fundamental difficulty must be faced. Economic nationalism is no solution. On the contrary, it is among the main causes of the world's troubles. Recovery depends on building up afresh and extending even more widely than before the worldwide exchanges of goods and services which everywhere cross national and political boundaries. The United Kingdom is far too small an area to form today an economic unit commensurate with the vast scale of modern commercial and industrial operations. The aim must always be the widest possible international cooperation. We have allowed the members of our feeble-minded to double themselves in the last 20 years. We have watched the purchasing power of our currency fluctuate wildly and play havoc with our economic life, and have been powerless to help ourselves. Another series of dashes. Notorious, unsuitable candidates, quote, get themselves elected, unquote. This is our habitual way of speaking of what happens to Parliament and the local councils. Prime ministers get nervously worn out in the mere effort to grapple with everyday business which faces them. Next subtitle. The failure of our political and economic machinery. Our political and economic machinery is breaking down. The great fund of individual and corporate goodwill, greater probably than at any previous period in our history, goes to waste, and all of our wills are frustrated for want of a large-scale plans on national reorganization. Neither in politics nor in economics have we grasped that the first and urgent necessity is planning ahead. Always centralization and planning are the tools and of the dictators. That's their first preference. We got to have a plan, and the person planning is an idiot, invariably. Particular projects, often of great political value, are put forward in Parliament or elsewhere without any effort being made to relate them either to each other or to a national plan, and they either break down or function imperfectly through needless friction engendered by the absence of ordered planning. Makes you wonder how the Soviet Union failed, huh? Frequently, where public opinion has become exasperated at its failure to get something done to remedy a defect which everyone recognizes as intolerable, our distracted legislators, with unanimity, unite to pass into law a compromise which is wanted by no one and merely aggravates the evil. It is a common occurrence for a government to be pursuing two or more mutually inconsistent policies at one and the same time. So he didn't doubt that planning overall is needed, while admitting that government planners are often operating at odds. Well, we need to just coordinate on a national level. One master plan. Then follows the trend of the subtle insinuating ideas meant to induce and reconcile the British people to the voluntary abandonment of their freedom, if thereby their country can be benefited. Thus are they meant to become the very victims of their genuine patriotism. The example they gave of sacrifice and self-discipline has been but one more tool in the hands of their double-faced leaders. They already sacrificed their gold to comply with the plea that in doing so they would save their country. This is referred to in the document in the following lines. Next quote, I'm calling a subtitle, Britain's Plight. Quote, Great Britain and some parts of the British Empire have in some degree improved their own position since last autumn. Absolutely, the improvement in Great Britain has been small, though relatively in other countries it is striking. This achievement is of real value to the world, even though some part of it has been made at the expense of added difficulties for others. It has been attained thanks to a remarkable demonstration of the self-discipline and well-disposed spirit of public services and the sober imperturbability and reasonableness of the British citizen in the face of a crisis. It is in this evidence of British character that the best hope for the future rests. It is this high feeling that must be exploited, and the next step is to show the people that their country's needs require of them the sacrifice of their individual freedom. Can we save our freedom? In quotes, asks Mr. Seif, and he advances the following line of arguments. Can we save our freedom? Next subtitle. Mr. Bernard Shaw's mordant words pose directly the poignant question. Is the national reconstruction possible without sacrifice of the essentials of personal and political freedom? For all their differences, Bolshevism and fascism have two outstanding features in common. Both stress the primary need for conscious forward planning on a national scale. Both repudiate the claims of personal and individual freedom. In this country, we hold fast to the concept of freedom as one of absolute validity. We know in our hearts that we are in imminent danger of losing both our freedom and our material well-being if we go on drifting. But if indeed national reorganization has to be bought at the price of losing our freedom, many of us feel that it would be better for humanity to descend once again into the abyss of barbarism and struggle painfully back at some later epoch to a civilization capable of satisfying both its material and its spiritual aspirations. Is the dilemma absolute? Can conscious forward planning of our economic life be reconciled with the essential and overriding claim of freedom? Is it true that what we need is more government and a great encroachment on liberty? Observe that it is in the sphere of our economic life, in the sphere of material things only, that conscious forward planning is demanded. Quote, may it not be that an unprejudiced re-examination of what we call freedom may reveal unexpected possibilities? Close quote. Three asterisks. In the realm of industry, the subversive opinion of the PEP is that to the doctrine of laissez-faire, or competitive initiative, should be substituted standardization, monopolies, and trusts, all under the rule of what Mr. Seif calls the Planning Authority. Whoever is acquainted with the protocols of the Elders of Zion knows that this Planning Authority can have its directing center only in the councils of the Supreme Jewish Kahal, where all planning and conscious forward planning have been done for centuries. We quote further, quote, a planning authority. Conscious planning leaves the consumer free, but involves the substitution of some organized control over overproduction and distribution on behalf of the community to take the place of that free play of the supposedly automatic economic forces on which laissez-faire relied. Supply and demand. Control implies a controlling machinery. To the average man and woman among us, there jumps to the mind at once the picture of a large number of new government departments and hordes of new officials attempting to take the place and do the work of the businessman, the manufacturer, the farmer, the banker, the shopkeeper, or at least to tie them all up hand and foot and dictate to them in the management of their daily affairs. And we see further a glimpse of Parliament and local bodies finally overwhelmed by the task of fulfilling their new duties and functions. Is there not a middle way, or better still, a new way of meeting the need for organizations and coordination of those economic tasks which the breakdown of laissez-faire is leaving unaccomplished? The new way found by the subtle PEP is the organization of public utility bodies, fashioned somewhat on the pattern of the BBC, Central Electric Board, etc., and we are told that it is possible to envisage a considerable extension of this form of organization of the nation's business. A new picture begins to emerge in the outline of industry, agriculture, transport, etc., enjoying, if not dominion status, at any rate wide powers of local self-government, with the cabinet, parliament, and the local authorities liberated from duties to which they are not ideally suited and free to perform their essential functions on behalf of the community. Next sub, the analogy of the electricity and grid system, or of the electricity grid system. Quote, the analogy of the grid system and the Central Electricity Board, not itself undertaking the production of power, nor the final distribution of electricity services to the consumer, but providing a coordinated system of carrying the electricity produced from the big generating stations to the local distributing centers all over the country, can be suggestively applied to other services. Imagine the dairy farmers of the country, or of various regional divisions of the country, as the milk generating stations, and the retailer of milk as the local distributing centers, with a central milk board conducting the business of bulk marketing of milk, and the milk as the grid of Britain. Already under Agricultural Marketing Act, there are signs of the coming of such a milk grid as a natural development to meet the needs of the day. An extension of the system, with suitable adaptations to other agricultural products, easily suggests itself, and even more directly as a method of dealing with the needs of modern transport by rail, road, water, and air. In the above quotation, we see the PEP sketching a program of distribution. From the organized control of distribution to that of production, under any despotic rule, there is but one step, and Mr. Seif has inevitably taken it. Moreover, being one of many Jews who have of late years concentrated on the multiple shop and chain stores systems and the organizations of various cartels and trusts, Mr. Seif could not refrain from dealing a blow at the independent retail stores, which for centuries have been the mainstay of British trade. To paralyze and thus eliminate the individual retail shopkeeper from trade has been one of the chief aims of Jewish planning. Remember, British were called a nation of shopkeepers. Although that was more or less intended as an insult, but here he's making the point that Jews are trying to cartelize and wipe out the independents as they did with banking. Let us now quote what is written on this subject. Quote, organized production. When we come to the organization of producers, agricultural, industrial, and the central electricity model becomes more difficult to follow. Methods of retailing cannot indeed be left entirely unchanged in the face of 20th century needs. The multiple shop and the chair store are already bringing about notable modifications. The waste involved in the 500,000 or more retail shops, one shop for every 20 households, cannot be allowed to continue to block the flow of goods from producer to consumer. And reorganization of retail methods is necessary to achieve the adequate organization of production. The development of an organized grid system for the distribution of milk must, it is certain, lead to profound modification of the traditional individualism outlook of the dairy farmer. And so it will be in other producing industries. Cooperative organization of the business of distribution cannot fail to bring about the conditions in which both the need and the will to organize themselves on a cooperative basis arise among the producers, whether they be agriculturalists, or producers of coal or of iron from the mines, or manufacturers of steel, or of cotton or of wool. Whether we like it or not, and many will dislike it intensely, the individualist manufacturers and farmers will be forced by events to submit to far-reaching changes in outlooks and methods. This is all quoted material. The danger is that in resisting them, because he regards them as encroachments on what he calls his freedom, he will make things much worse for himself and for the community. Resistance is likely to play into the hands of those who say that tinkering is useless and that full-blooded socialism or communism are the only cure. Or he may be tempted to flirt with fascist ideas. In either case, he loses his cherished freedom, and it is only too probable that fascism and communism alike would be but short stages on the road to barbarism. It would be more difficult, or it would be difficult to imply threats in a more outspoken manner. And Mr. Seif goes on to state that, so either he's basically saying that we're going to socialize this. It is idle, quote from Seif, the Jew, it is idle to deny that some, at least, of the changes required when conscious forward planning extends into the field of production are of a revolutionary character. It is all important that we should appraise them soberly and without prejudice, and distinguish clearly between unavoidable alterations of methods or economic organizations and fundamental attacks on our personal and political freedom. Without entering more deeply into details than space here allows, the position of the farmer and manufacturer under a system of planned production can only be sketched in broad outlines. He may be conceived of as remaining in full control of all the operations of his farm or factory, but receiving from the duly constituted authorities instructions as to the quantity and quality of his production, and as to the markets in which he will sell. He will himself have had a voice in setting his constituted authority, and will have regular means of communicating with it and of influencing its policy. He will be less exposed than at present to interference from above, that is, from government departments and local bodies and their inspectors. He will be less free to make arbitrary decisions as to his own business outside the region of day-to-day operation of the plant or farm. It must be presumed that the constituted authority will be armed by enabling legislation, act of parliament, and by a majority decision of its own members, presumably elected by votes of those minorities in clearly specified cases. All this is not very different from what already occurs in particular organized industries, like the electricity they mentioned, but must be conceived of as applying generally to most, if not all, of the major fields of production, and as part of a conscious and systematically planned agricultural and industrial organization. Close quote. Having thus given out the basic principles upon which the Judeo-Fabian new structure of British economic life is to be erected, an outline of the organization which will direct the functioning of the plan is given. A national plan in outline, in quotes, and quote. An outline of the organization contemplated would be somewhat as follows. Quote, a national planning commission with advisory, not executive functions, subordinate to the cabinet and the parliament, but with clearly defined powers of initiative and clearly defined responsibilities, its personal representative of the nation's economic life. A national council for agriculture, a national council for industry, a steel industry corporation, a milk producers corporation, organized on the lines of public utility concern, serving at least to federate, and in suitable cases to own, the plants, factories, etc. engaged in production. A series of public utility corporations dealing with distributive services, e.g. the Central Electricity Board, the National Transport Board, or a number of regional transport boards, the National Milk Marketing Board. In the constitution of these bodies, provision would naturally be made for suitable representation of interests, including organized labor, and for their due coordination by means, for example, of the election by various corporations of some of their members to serve on the national councils. To all of them, Parliament would delegate considerable powers to regulate the affairs of their particular industries. So far, so good. Any ideologist or crack-brained human being can devise some kind of utopia. In fact, most of the inmates of lunatic asylums have been interned for that very reason. However, they are usually pronounced dangerous for society from the moment that they attempt to work out their fantasy into reality. So this Jew is going to redesign Britain. Plans for the realization of Mr. Seif's weird ideas have already been made. They are summed up in two words: compulsion, all caps, and exportation, all caps. Reading the following quotations, one is forcibly reminded of the tenets preached in New York at the Rand School in the meetings of the, quote, Friends of Soviet Russia, unquote. Quote, from the standpoint of encroachments upon freedom, apart from the denial of the tenets of individualism, the most obvious target for attack are perhaps the proposed grant of powers to compel minorities and, point not yet mentioned, the probable necessity for drastic changes in the ownership of land. Powers of compulsion of minorities are not unknown under present conditions and will probably not arouse very violent antagonism on the ground of high principle. The question of private ownership of land is one which never fails to encounter deep-rooted passions. It is also one which arises immediately in almost every aspect of consciously planned reconstruction. That, hey, these people already own this land. The conclusion seems to be inescapable that whether in the field of town and country planning, or in that of agricultural or rural planning, or in the organization of industry, it is not possible to make reasonable progress without drastic powers to buy out individual owners of land. This is not to say that land nationalization, in the ordinary sense of the term, is either necessary or desirable, far from it. Nothing would be gained by substituting the state as landlord. What is required, if only with a view to equitable treatment of individuals, is transfer or ownership of large blocks of land, not necessarily of all the land in the country, but certainly of a large portion of it, into the hands of the proposed statutory corporations and public utility bodies, and of land trusts. In many cases, all that would be needed would be the conversion of rights of ownership of land into rights of participations as shareholders in the new corporations or in land trusts. It would be possible further, in a large number of cases, to leave management undisturbed, together with the enjoyment of the amenities which at present go with ownership, subject to the transfer of title to the corporations or trusts. Here again, limits of space preclude fuller treatment of the subject. All that is here relevant is the inevitable conclusion that the planned economy, which the nation needs to meet the demands of the 20th century, must clearly involve drastic inroads upon the rights of individual ownership of land as at present understood. Close quote. Three asterisk separation. As to finance and the right of citizens to deal freely with their money, Mr. Seif's kind solicitude for the property of others has prompted him to formulate the following point of view so worthy of paternal Bolshevism. Quote, stable money cannot be secured without the considerable extension of control on behalf of the community over free flow of investment and the uses to which the individuals make of their capital. While as a consumer he can retain full freedom of choice as to competing wants he will satisfy, there are real difficulties in leaving him entirely free to invest his savings in any way he chooses. So they're going to completely and from the top down distort the economy in the way that the Jew Bolshevist sees fit. It is probable that many of these difficulties can be solved on the one hand by extension of the system of insurance on lines to which recent developments of the motoring law again supply suggestive analogies and, on the other hand, by means of which, while leaving the small capitalist untrammeled, will so canalize, that is, direct into a canal, the flow of both long and short-term investment of the large sums which are at the disposal of banks and financial institutions as well as funds in the hands of large insurance companies, as to ensure that adequate capital is available for the big industrial, agricultural, and distributive corporations already envisaged. So they want to take control of all the industry and the productive capacity. The only thing you're going to be left with is the ability to decide which of, you know, whether you want to buy some milk or something from the soda board or milk board or whatever giant government cartel is set up. A series of cartels that is centralizing economic power the way they do political power, with themselves running it and profiting from it. You left with no money and no choice. Then comes the discussion of the problem of labor, which points out the future uselessness of the present trade unions, who still labor under the delusion that they have achieved the ne plus ultra of good conditions for workmen. The PEP will reorganize them. Social services, in italics, a PEP organization will, among other things, quote, call for a big change in the organization of the medical profession, which has, at present, too often a vested interest in disease, unquote. Needless to add that, quote, imperial planning, unquote, and, quote, international planning, unquote, have also been the object to Mr. Seif's careful attention. Suffice it to quote the conclusive words of his scheme, quote, the only rival world political and economic system which put forward a comparable claim is that of the USSR. The conclusion is almost naive, but far from surprising when we know that the, quote, plans, unquote, for the disruption of Russia and enslavement of the Russian people were made in the councils of the Jewish Kahal, of which Mr. Seif is a prominent member. Let us now see what is to be the fate of this British constitution, of which every Briton is so proud, justly proud. Quote, nevertheless, our first plan is to replan Britain. Effective planning on the economic side, and even the introduction of desirable reforms in detail, has become impossible without a drastic overhauling both of Parliament and the central government and of the machinery of local government. Political and economic planning are complementary and supplementary to each other and must be carefully interrelated. We need new economic and political institutions to match the new social adjustments which applied science has created, and a new technique in both politics and industry to enable us to find intelligent methods of surmounting new difficulties and complexities. Quote, it has been suggested more than once in the course of this essay that devolution of powers to statutory bodies will be an important feature of the new order, and that in the result Parliament and the Cabinet will be relieved of some part of their present duties and set free to the great advantage of themselves and of the nation for their proper task of directing and guiding public policy. Big consequent changes will follow in the machinery of government. And anyone inclined to criticize Mr. Seif's marvelous scheme of destruction of all existing social, political, and economic order, the following answer is given. Quote, one possible answer is, of course, to refer our critic to what was said at the outset as to the imminence of catastrophe if we continue to drift, so that they're pretext. Oh, there's going to be this terrible catastrophe if you don't let Jews plan everything. Of course, ridiculous. Reluctance to embark on a doubtful adventure deserves a less negative treatment. Quote, the dangers which our critics fear are real dangers. Our statutory corporations and public utility boards may easily become unadventurous obstacles to progress, determined enemies to all new ideas. It may be indeed that one of the lessons we have to learn from our present distress is that scientific invention itself requires some planning in its application to the economic structure of the nation. The problem of progress is no longer the problem of getting enough chance to prevent routine from deadening effort, but the problem of preventing change from destroying both routine and all social stability. Quote, this, however, is no justification of institutions which deaden effort. Quote, our proposals must rather be defended by the claim that they will liberate the spirit of initiative and not deaden it, in that they will provide means by which the energetic man of business may escape from the disheartening frustrations and failures which are caused by the complexity of the machine, and will give him scope for serving his generation in a larger kingdom than the narrow field of competition, in italics, with rivals in particular industrial or commercial pursuits. Quote, though organized on public utility lines with monopolistic capital letters, privileges. The all caps, great industrial corporations, cartelizing all these industries, is the proposal, will find ample room for energy and initiative in performing their primary tasks of combining maximum with minimum costs of production. The executive heads of particular factories will not lack the spur of competition. Lastly, we need to be told that, quote, experience alone can prove the justice of our claim that economic freedom will not be fatally shackled by the effort of conscious forward planning. Experience, too, will be needed to make clear the boundaries of the province within which individualistic effort can best be relied upon to secure the highest national dividend. Dot, dot, dot. How forcibly one is here reminded of the words of the apostles and disciples of Lenin and Trotsky Bronstein, who so loudly proclaimed that the imposition of Bolshevism in Russia was but a great experiment. Is a 5-year plan of enforced labor to be imposed also upon the British people? Silence surrounds the results of the same experiments in Mexico, Spain, and South American states, because it is the policy of the destructors of our Christian civilization to muzzle the press that they own. But England, though ruled by the chosen of the Cahal, namely the revolutionary Fabian group, is given a warning in time and can therefore frame a line of defense. The justification of the, quote, conscious forward planning, unquote, scheme is given as the final part of Mr. Seif's masterpiece. The irony of calling a destruction a conservative evolution will not escape the reader. Jew presents a thing as its opposite. Conservative evolution, in quotes. Quote, indeed the socialist or communist will condemn our planning as mere tinkering with the outworn machine of capitalism. To him it will appear a hopelessly conservative and anemic attempt to stave off the red-blooded revolution which alone would satisfy him. Our plan is, we claim, conservative in the truest and best sense. It is constructive, not destructive, and built solidly upon the present and the past. It faces the issue boldly, and it is not afraid to challenge vested interest and deeply cherished habits of thought and action. It does not, however, propose to expropriate anyone, and in requiring the application of compulsion in a limited sphere, it is not doing more than extend and make explicit and give systematic application to tendencies and practices already at work. We're just going to go the way things are already going, a little harder. Such sketch, in the broadest outlines of the lines which Reconstruction might take as has already been given here, must inevitably raise more questions in the mind of the attentive reader than it answers. It does, says the writer. Mr. Seif's document is as clear an expose of a policy calculated to kill human initiative and the spirit of competition which means progress as is given in the protocols of the wise men of Zion. Will the British people allow themselves to be further bamboozled by those who have already got the best of their fine spirit of patriotism and intend to exploit it still more? Yes, the political, economic, and spiritual needs of England require as much scope of freedom today and in the future as they ever did in the past. The foregoing quotations have given but a very succinct expose of, quote, conscious forward planning, unquote, as given out by Israel Moses Seif. The analogies between his utterances and the contents of the document known under the title of the Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion, first published in 1905, are very striking indeed. We quote but a few taken from the edition of the Protocols published by Small and Maynard of Boston, Massachusetts, USA, in 1920. Analogies with the Protocols. Page 26, fifth paragraph. Quote, there is nothing more dangerous than individual initiative, unquote. If it had a not unquote, continued quote, that was in italics, there is nothing more dangerous than an individual initiative, colon. If it had a touch of genius, it can accomplish more than 1 million people among whom we have sown dissensions. We must direct the education of Goy society so that arms will drop hopelessly when they face every task where initiative is required. The intensity of action resulting from the individual freedom of action dissipates its force when it encounters another person's freedom. This results in heavy blows at morals, disappointments, and failures. Page 27, sixth paragraph. we will soon begin to establish huge monopolies, reservoirs of huge wealth, upon which even the large fortunes of the Goys will depend to such an extent that they will be drowned, together with the governmental credits, on the day following the political catastrophe. Page 27, sixth paragraph. Quote, the aristocracy of the Goys as a political force is dead. We do not need to take it into consideration. But as landowners, they are harmful to us because they can be independent in their sources of life. For this reason, we must deprive them of their land at any cost. Page 34, tenth paragraph. For this reason, our plans must be strongly and clearly conceived. These plans will not immediately upset contemporary institutions. They will only alter their organization and consequently the entire combination of their development, which will thus be directed according to plans laid down by us. Page 44, 13th paragraph. To divert the over-restless people from discussing political problems, we now make it appear that we provide them with new problems, namely those pertaining to industry. Let them become excited over this subject as much as they like. I have a feeling if they were writing that 100 years later, like today, they'd be talking about sports more than, although they did mention sports back then, I think they'd be emphasizing it more today than industry. And so that puts us on page 287 and the conclusion, which goes just a couple of pages, and then we've got or at least one appendix. On rereading the foregoing pages before sending them to press, the writer is painfully aware of their inadequacy. The subject is too vast and too unfamiliar to the general public to permit of successful treatment in a small volume. It has been necessary to compress, at the risk of fatiguing and even antagonizing the reader, by excessive brevity and abrupt transitions. At the same time, the author has had to take counsel of prudence in the selection of material. For the Jews have always counted on the fact that, if the whole truth were told in one comprehensive utterance, no one would believe it. Thus bigots and minds bursting with the discoveries they have made have never been feared by the Jews. People are incapable of believing or receiving a certain knowledge which runs counter to their habitual manner of thinking. Facts are not accepted on proof, but on understanding. Interesting idea. Facts are not accepted on proof, but on understanding. Oh, I see. Oh. And you formally proved it? Well, you know, whatever. Oh, I was conceiving of Jews as this. Like good guys. Smarter and suffered more. But you're they're actually the bad guys. Oh, damn. On understanding. Yet the problem is of such pressing interest, and the lurking evil so destructive that silence is complicity. In daily life, isn't it funny to see that? That's usually used with leftist stuff, but here it's used for right-wing stuff. Maybe we should pick that up and that meme up and run with it. Silence is complicity when it comes to speaking the truth about Jews or refraining from speaking the truth. In daily life, the serpent of Judah lies in wait in every bypath for its Gentile victims, and few are those cunning enough to escape its fangs. In social and political circles, in business and in art, wherever one probes, Zionism raises its ugly head, surgit atrox et spinosa, and suddenly reveals itself as all-powerful. And interesting, this is very similar to what Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf. Every time you probe an abscess, a Jew roach, Jew cockroach, runs from the light. But its power is magnified because concealed. Just as a venomous snake is more dangerous hidden in the grass than exposed on a broad, level road. It is therefore very encouraging to note, each year, and in nearly every country, the issue of new publications, footnote 1, e.g., Le Patriot of Montreal, devoted to the defense of local and national interest against, quote, bad cosmopolitanism and bad finance. Second footnote, which reads, the words of Sir Mark Sykes, supra, that is, cited in the one above, Le Patriot of Montreal, Mark Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S, page 55. These books and periodicals reach the public as the result of exceptional perseverance and sacrifice, footnote 3. In addition to the difficulty and expense of publication, authors and editors are constantly faced with the alternative of paying heavy fines or serving a term in jail. For talking about Jews, honestly. These books and periodicals reach the public as the result of exceptional perseverance and sacrifice on the part of the authors and publishers. Nor are the vigorous campaigns of the older patriotic groups, footnote 4, which reads, as for instance in London, the Britons, the Britons, quotations, and the group that publishes the admirably edited weekly, The Patriot. Nor are the vigorous campaigns of the older patriotic groups, the Britons and the Patriot, in England, Canada and the U.S., to mention only three English-speaking countries, a matter of less satisfaction. These signs indicate the growth, during the past 10 years, of a small but intelligent minority determined to fight to the last ditch and learning to wield its single weapon, publicity, with increased skill and effectiveness. For the cardinal fact is this. Once the screen of secrecy has been removed, once Zionism has been dragged into the open, the peoples of the earth will know how to deal with the death blow. In Palestine, there have been Zionist movements since the days of Nehemiah. They have always ended in failure because their success depended on secrecy, and it was impossible to keep the secret from their own race for long. This world Zionism has gone incomparably farther because for generations, the Jews have maintained secrecy among themselves as against the Goyim. No organization with a predetermined aim, such as Zionism, can achieve success without secrecy. Its program, elaborated in the course of centuries, is necessarily rigid in its main features. It will not bend or ply to suit circumstances, but everything must be ground to fit the mold. This is possible if people are led, little by little, to adopt each feature of the program, to regard it as their own choice, and thus put the heavy yoke on their own necks. But if the people should realize that this yoke of iron, which the Kahal has been so long in forging, is now being imposed on them, they would have none of it. Such is the problem in its broader aspect. From the outlook of the individual, on the other hand, it is clear that a serious study of the whole question is richly rewarded. Beneath the changing surface of things, the new names and the specious promises, it is easy to recognize the old issue, the real movers behind the scenes, and their definite aims. After a year's study, the observer should be able to follow all the big moves in the Jewish game and predict, with amazing accuracy, the course which Zionism will take under given circumstances, and the one along which it will seek to guide the world at large. The one thing Zionists cannot do is change their secret program. It binds them as they would bind the world. It is therefore essential to master all the points of this program in order to recognize each under its manifold disguises. The man who has done this holds in his hand a lever with which to pry Zionism out of its concealment. If he is discreet and courageous, he need fear nothing. In his ears will sound the words, quote, "Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you." Footnote 5, Luke 10:19. Zionism risks more by attacking such a man than he by attacking Zionism, against which new enemies spring up every day from the least expected quarters of the globe. Our concern is, therefore, not so much for the ultimate survival of free Gentile nations, as for the national freedom and culture of our own and the next succeeding generations. Now is the time to resist in ourselves and to stir others to resist that subtle, hypnotic current drawing towards the East to slavery and sensuality, to Babylonian pomp and spiritual desolation. The beauty of Greece, the freedom and courage of the North, the Christianity of Western Europe, these are our heritage. Their spirit lives in us, and it is our duty and privilege to defend it. That's from June 1934, and that closes the, this book, save for an appendix, which we will read now. It goes on for 8 or 9 pages. Appendix, a protocol of 1860. We take this protocol from the Morning Post of September 6, 1920. Quote, a correspondent, writing in reference to the hidden peril, draws attention to a manifesto issued in 1860 to the Jews of the Universe by Adolphe Cremieux, the founder of the Alliance Israélite Universelle and the well-known member of the Provisional Government of 1871. Adolphe Cremieux, while Grand Master of the French Masonic Lodges, offered 1 million francs for the head of William I of Germany. On his tomb, he requested the following sole inscription to be inscribed: "Here lies Adolphe Cremieux, the founder of the Alliance Israélite Universelle." They would be called the French Anti-Racist Group. They would call themselves suing people like comedians who make jokes about Jews. The manifesto, next. Emblem, on top, the tablets of Moses, a little lower, two extended hands clasping each other, and as a basis of the whole, the globe of the earth. Motto, all Jews for one, and one for all. The union which we desire to found will not be a French, English, Irish, or German union, but a Jewish one, a universal one. Other peoples and races are divided into nationalities. We alone have not co-citizens, but exclusively co-religionaries. A Jew will under no circumstance become the friend of a Christian or a Muslim before the moment arrives when the light of the Jewish faith, the only religion of reason, will shine all over the world. Scattered amongst other nations, who from time immemorial were hostile to our rights and interest, we desire primarily to be and to remain immutably Jews. Our nationality is the religion of our fathers, and we recognize no other nationality. And that's why they have no cares to destroy nations like Germany or the U.S. We are living in foreign lands and cannot trouble about the mutable ambitions of countries entirely alien to us while our own moral and material problems are endangered. The Jewish teaching must cover the whole earth, Israelites. Israelites, no matter where fate should lead, though scattered all over the earth, you must always consider yourselves of a chosen race. If you realize that the faith of your forefathers is your only patriotism, if you recognize that, notwithstanding the nationalities you have embraced, you always remain and everywhere form one and only nation, if you believe the Jewry only is the one and only religious and political truth, if you are convinced of this, you, Israelites of the universe, then come and give ear to our appeal and prove to us your consent. Our cause is great and holy, and its success is guaranteed. Catholicism, our immemorial enemy, is lying in the dust, mortally wounded in the head. The net which Israel is throwing over the globe of the earth is widening and spreading daily, and the momentous prophecies of our holy books are at last to be realized. The time is near when Jerusalem will become the house of prayer for all nations and peoples, and the banner of Jewish mono-deity will be unfurled and hoisted on the most distant shores. Let us avail ourselves of all circumstances. Our might is immense. Learn to adopt this might for our cause. What have you to be afraid of? The day is not distant when all the riches and treasures of the earth will become the property of the children of Israel. A Protocol of 1869. The Fatal Discourse of Rabbi Reichhorn, R-E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N. In its issue of October 21st, 1920, number 195, La Vieille France, the Old France, published an extremely important Russian document in which the following passage occurs. Quote, "There is a striking analogy between the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the discourse of the Rabbi Reichhorn pronounced in Prague in 1869 over the tomb of the Grand Rabbi Simeon ben Ehuda," that means like Simeon, son of Ehuda, "and published by Redcliffe, who paid with his life for the divulgation." Redcliffe. Sonol, S-O-N-O-L, who had taken Redcliffe to hear Reichhorn, was killed in a duel sometime afterwards. The general ideas formulated by the rabbi are found fully developed in the protocols. In its issue of March 10, 1921, number 214, La Vieille France gives the version of this funeral oration which was published in La Russie Juive, the Jewish Russia. It is perfectly clear that the funeral oration and the protocols of the Elders of Zion come from one and the same mint. Both are prophetic, that means they predict the future, and the power which made the prophecies has been able to bring about their fulfillment. This oration is so important that we append it to it an account of the fulfillment of each of the sections. There can no longer be any doubt as to whose is the power which is disturbing the world, creating world unrest, and at the same time reaping all the profits. Jewry is enslaving all Christian peoples of the earth. There is a Jew world plot, and it now stands finally and completely unmasked. Number of points here. 19 to be specific. 1. Every 100 years, we, the sages of Israel, have been accustomed to meet in Sanhedrin, a council of rabbis, in order to examine our progress towards the domination of the world, which Jehovah has promised us, and our conquests over the enemy, Christianity. 2. This year, united over the tomb of our Reverend Simeon ben Yehuda, we can state with pride that the past century has brought us very near to our goal, and that this goal will be very soon attained. 3. Gold always has been and always will be the irresistible power. Handled by expert hands, it will always be the most useful lever for those who possess it, and the object of envy for those who do not. With gold we can buy the most rebellious consciences, can fix the rate of all values, the current price of all products, can subsidize all state loans, and thereafter hold the states at our mercy. 4. Already the principal banks, the exchanges of the entire world, the credits of all the governments are in our hands. 5. The other great power is the press. By repeating without cessation certain ideas, the press succeeds in the end in having them accepted as actualities. The theater renders us analogous services. Again, this is before he would say TV nowadays. Everywhere the press and the theater obey our orders. 6. By the ceaseless praise of democratic rule, we shall divide the Christians into political parties. We shall destroy the unity of their nations. We shall sow discord everywhere. Reduced to impotence, they will bow before the law of our bank, always united and always devoted to our cause. We shall force the Christians into wars by exploiting their pride and their stupidity. They will massacre each other and clear the ground for us to put our own people into. 8. The possession of the land has always brought influence and power. In the name of social justice and equality, we shall parcel out the great estates. We shall give the fragments to the peasants who covet them with all their powers, and will soon be in debt to us by the expense of cultivating them. Our capital will make us their masters. We in turn shall become the great proprietors, and the possession of the land will assure the power to us. 9. Let us try to replace the circulation of gold with paper money. Our chest will absorb the gold, and we shall regulate the value of the paper, which will make us masters of all the positions. 10. We count among us plenty of orators, capable of feigning enthusiasm and of persuading mobs. We shall spread them among the people to announce changes which should secure the happiness of the human race. By gold and by flattery, we shall gain the proletariat, which will charge itself with annihilating Christians' capitalism. We shall promise workmen salaries of which they have never dared to dream, but we shall also raise the price of necessity so that our profits will be greater still. 11. In this manner we shall prepare revolutions, which the Christians will make themselves, and of which we shall reap the fruit. 12. By our mockeries and our attacks upon them, we shall make their priests ridiculous, then odious, and their religion as ridiculous and odious as their clergy. Then we shall be the masters of their souls, for our pious attachments to our own religion and the superiority of our souls. 13. We have already established our own men in all important positions. We must endeavor to provide the goyim with lawyers and doctors. The lawyers are au courant with all interest. The doctors, once in the house, become confessors and directors of consciences. But above all, let us monopolize education. By this means, we spread ideas that are useful to us and shape the children's brains as suits us. 15. If one of our people should unhappily fall into the hands of justice amongst the Christians, we must rush to help him, find as many witnesses as he needs to save him from his judges until we become judges ourselves. 16. The monarchs of the Christian world, swollen with ambition and vanity, surround themselves with luxury and with numerous armies. We shall furnish them with all the money their folly demands, and so shall keep them in leash. 17. Let us take care not to hinder the marriage of our men with Christian girls, for through them we shall get our foot into the most closely locked circles. If our daughters marry Goyim, they will be no less useful. For the children of a Jewish mother are ours. Let us foster the idea of free love, that we may destroy among Christian women attachment to the principles and practices of their religion. For ages past, the sons of Israel, despised and persecuted, have been working to open up a path to power. They are hitting the mark. They control the economic life of the accursed Christians. Their influence preponderates over politics and over manners. 19. At the wished-for hour, fixed in advance, we shall let loose the revolution, which, by ruining all classes of Christianity, will definitely enslave the Christians to us. Thus will be accomplished the promise of God made to his people. And finally, we got one last bit, a protocol of 1919. A Russian newspaper, Prizyv, of 5th, P-R-I-Z-Y-V, of 5 February 1920, published in Berlin, contained an interesting document in Hebrew, dated December 1919, which was found in the pocket of the dead Jew Zunder, Z-U-N-D-E-R, the Bolshevik commander of the 11th Sharpshooter Battalion, throwing light on the secret organization of Jewry in Russia. In extenso, it ran as follows. Secret. To the representatives of all the branches of the Israelite International League. Sons of Israel, the hour of our ultimate victory is near. We stand on the threshold to the command of the world. That which we could only dream of before is about to be realized. Only quite recently, feeble and powerless, we can now, thanks to the world's catastrophe, raise our heads with pride. We must, however, be careful. Can surely be prophesied that, after we have marched over ruined and broken altars and thrones, we shall advance further in the same indicated path. The authority of the, to us, alien religious and doctrines of faith we have, through very successful propaganda, subjected to a merciless criticism and mockery, we have brought the culture, civilization, traditions, and thrones of the Christian nations to stagger. We have done everything to bring the Russian people under the yoke of the Jewish power and ultimately compelled them to fall on their knees before us. We have very nearly completed all this, but we must be all the same be very cautious because the oppressed Russian is our arch enemy. The victory over Russia, gained through our intellectual superiority, may in the future, in a new generation, turn against us. Russia is conquered and brought to the ground. Russia is in the agony of death under our heel. But do not forget, even for a moment, that we must be careful. The holy care for our safety does not allow us to show either pity or mercy. At last we have been allowed to behold the bitter need of the Russian people and to see it in tears. By taking from them their property, their gold, we have reduced this people to helpless slaves. Be cautious and silent. We ought to have no mercy for our enemy. We must make an end of the best in leading Russia, elements of the Russian people, so that the vanquished Russia may not find any leader. Thereby every possibility will vanquish for them to resist our power. We must excite hatred and disputes between workers and peasants. War and class struggle will destroy all treasures and culture created by the Christian people. But be cautious, sons of Israel. Our victory is near because our political and economic power and influence upon the masses are in rapid progress. We buy up government loans and gold, and thereby we have controlling power over the world's exchanges. The power is in our hands, but be careful. Place no faith in traitorous, shady powers. Bronstein, Trotsky, Applebaum, Zinoviev, Rosenfeld, Kamenev, Steinberg, all of them are likened to thousands of other true sons of Israel. Our power in Russia is unlimited. In the towns, the commissariats and commissions of food, house commissions, etc., are dominated by our people. But do not let victory intoxicate you. Be careful, cautious, because no one except yourselves will protect us. Remember, we cannot rely on the Red Army, which one day may turn its warfare on ourselves. Sons of Israel, the hour for our long-cherished victory over Russia is near. Close up solid your ranks. Make known our people's national policy. Fight for eternal ideals. Keep holy the old laws which history has bequeathed to us. May our intellect, our genius, protect and lead us. Signed, the Central Committee of the Petersburg Branch of the Israelite International League. And that's how the protocols, this book, closes. And I mean, if you can't tell what needs to be done to Jews, man, I'm not even going to bother saying it. Because it's self-evident. Most disturbing thing ever written or read, I would have to say, in the history of the world. These people are out to destroy all others. And when you know that, what is there really left to know? Nothing. There's only organizing against it. And that's where the notional Team White comes in. Thanks for listening to this series of sessions on the Protocols of the International Jew. I'll be back with you again, and we'll go over some other material real soon.